Welcome to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Well, the study of linguistics, as I see it, is just mainly an effort to discover the roots of human nature in particular cognitive domains.
Do you think of yourself as a psychologist or a linguist? I mean, is it the same thing for you?
I have no profession, and I also have no professional credential. I mean, the disciplinary boundaries are, they're not meaningless, but they don't mean, nobody believes that they cut nature at the joints.
Right.
They're conveniences. You know,
they're encouraged sometimes to take pride in their home language. There's still, I think, a pretty strong feeling that they get that this is something that's okay to use at home, perhaps, but still it's not good enough. Look at, for example, the autobiography of Richard Rodriguez and his attitude toward growing up in a Spanish-speaking home and having to acquire English and looking with shame on the language of his youth and his parents. I think that's still a pretty common phenomenon for non-English speakers growing up in the U.S.
Language and culture, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with two leading scholars of language and culture. You'll hear first from Noam Chomsky of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Following that, I'll talk with Dennis Barron of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Noam Chomsky is the author of numerous books about language, grammar, and syntax. During his recent visit to the National Humanities Center, I asked him to talk about where language comes from and what distinguishes human speech from animal communication. Here is Noam Chomsky.
Relatively uncontroversially, our brains are implicated in language, and there's something about our brains which makes it possible for us to acquire language, and in fact which compels a child to acquire language in a normal setting. That's uncontroversial. Well, let's just give it a name, call it the language faculty.
Mm-hmm.
So the language faculty is some element of the human brain. Now, it doesn't mean that it's an element that you can cut out, but it's part of this system of organization. Now, it's an organ in the sense that the circulatory system is an organ.
Uh-huh.
You can't cut the circulatory system out of the body.
It has to do with function.
Well, it's there. Uh-huh. I mean, there's some kind of physical, take say the circulatory system. It's
mm-hmm.
not a perfect analogy, but it's a suggestive one. If a biologist wants to study the way the human body works, they may very well talk about the circulatory system as one of the systems of the body
mm-hmm.
without any illusion that you can cut the circulatory system out and leave the body. That wouldn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's also, the circulatory system is not abstract. I mean, these things are actually there.
It's physical.
But the things that are there may be serving many functions, one of them being part of the circulatory system, one being something else. You know?
You're inviting us to be holistic, as it were, to think of language as a part of a complex of many other circumstances in our makeup.
Well, we have the brain is a very, we don't understand much about the brain, but it's doubtless one of the most complex, maybe the most complex organ in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it has many different interlocking structures, and one of them in the human brain, and apparently only in the human brain, is this capacity to develop a language, and that's got to be physically represented somehow if we're not mystics, but we don't know how.
What about animals? Can they talk? I mean, there's a lot of the anthropologists and the semioticians and the theorists haggle over this conference after conference. How do they communicate? How do they?
Well, they certainly communicate. Uh-huh. I mean, if you go down to the level of insects, they communicate. In fact, there's no organism known that doesn't have communication.
But it's not speech.
Well, you know, that's not a meaningful question. I mean, if you were to ask, suppose you asked 70 years ago,
what was speech?
Can airplanes fly?
Yeah.
Well, whether airplanes fly or not is a matter of decision, not a matter of fact.
So is it a question of content rather than means?
The question is, what's the nature of animal communication systems?
Uh-huh.
And that's one question. And the answer is that animal communication systems are radically different in every major respect that we know of from human systems. In fact, human language is not, it's misleading to call it a communication system. I mean, it's used for communication, but it's used for many other things as well. It's used for establishing social relations, for telling jokes, for expressing your thoughts, for commiserating with people about the world or whatever. There are all kinds of things that language is used for. Of course, it's also used for communication, but it's not a communication system.
Is it fair to say that human language as we know it is the most sophisticated of all the means of communication that that we know? Or, I mean, is that arrogant of us to think that way?
Well, I mean, it's not so much that it's arrogant as that it's misleading. It's qualitatively different from animal communication systems. Now, animal communication systems, in some respects, animal communication systems are sometimes more richer than language. So take, say, the communication system of the bees. That has the formal property called continuity. That means a bee can indicate to another bee the distance of a flower, and it can do it across a continuous dimension. So between any two points in principle, there's another point. Human language isn't like that. It's discrete. So there's a six-word sentence and a seven-word sentence, but there's no six-and-a-half-word sentence. So from a certain point of view, you could argue that the bee communication system is richer than the human language. Of course, that's meaningless because there's no, they're not commensurate. They just have different characteristics, totally.
What about artificial intelligence, Noam Chomsky? Do you have any strong views, weak views about strong AI, weak AI, that sort of thing?
Well, I think that that whole subject is based on deep conceptual confusions, and therefore it's impossible to answer the question. Again, when we ask about artificial intelligence, we're assuming that we know what intelligence is. Let me again go back to the analogy of flying. Suppose we know that birds fly. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now suppose somebody shows us an airplane and they ask us, is that flying? Mm-hmm. Well, we can make any if we can make any decision we like about that. It's not a factual matter. In fact, languages handle it differently. In English, you say the airplane flies. In other languages, you use a different word for it. And there's no fact of the matter. The question is whether the analogy between what birds are doing and what airplanes are doing is compelling enough so that we decide to make a metaphoric extension of the word fly to that. Mm-hmm. And that's just a matter of decision. And the same is true of so-called machine intelligence. I mean, we can ask, from a scientific point of view, there's a question that you would ask about a computer program. Namely, does it teach you anything about the way humans think? If it does, then it's a contribution to science. If it doesn't, then it's just some other thing which has some similarity to what humans do, and you decide whether that similarity is enough for your present purposes so that you'll call it intelligence. Mm-hmm. But that's not a question with content. From a scientific point of view, I mean, if you think about, if take it from a scientific point of view, people talk about machines thinking, but that's misleading. Machines aren't doing anything. What's doing something is the program in the machine.
Yeah, machines do what they're told to do.
So the question is that program doing something interesting? Mm-hmm. Now, a program is just a theory. A program is a theory written in a notation which allows it to be implemented by a computer. You could write it in a different notation if you liked. So the question you're now asking is whether this theory is telling us something about humans. And then we treat it like any other theory. Mm-hmm. Some theories are informative, some theories are uninformative. These theories happen to be overwhelmingly uninformative, so therefore they're not interesting from a scientific point of view.
Let me bring you back, apropos of these comments, Noam Chomsky, to two terms, transformational grammar and generative grammar. These are very complex issues. Will you give me a quick take on that and tell me how they relate to your notions of patterns in our minds, our innate capability for language?
Well, one of the perhaps the most elementary property of human language that you and I and every normal human share is that although we have finite brains, those finite brains allow us to construct and interpret an unbounded range of expressions.
In other words, a doctor, in theory, a physician or an experimental scientist might be able to take a portion or an entire human brain and say, this brain is capable of no more than 8 million sentences.
Yeah, but
that's not true. And yet, in its life, this person has concocted 40 million sentences.
We know that there's no limit to the number of sentences that we can, in principle, understand. If you give people
finite brain, infinite number of generations.
That's a traditional insight. Uh-huh. Traditional, you go back to the 18th century, 19th century, people are talking about the fundamental property of language being that somehow it makes infinite use of finite means. Mm-hmm. And that's clearly correct if you think for a minute, even within the normal range of sentence length, say, you know, short sentences, the number of sentences from which we sample and which we understand instantaneously is absolutely astronomical. They can't possibly be stored. It's out of the question. So there's some kind of finite resources that allow for unbounded capacity. Now, the theory of that finite system is what's called a generative grammar. That is, generate is a technical term which simply means it characterizes infinitely many structures.
And that's peculiar to you and your work. You've been called a pioneer, for instance.
Well, you know, anybody who thinks about the topic for a minute is going to understand that you have to have a generative grammar, simply because these properties are fundamental elementary properties of language. And in the early 19th century, as I mentioned, there was already explorations. There was already a clear recognition that language has to somehow involve infinite use of finite means. Now, at that time, it was impossible to give a clear characterization of what that notion meant. In the 1920s and the 1930s, the relevant conceptual tools were developed in mathematics and in logic. And by the 1940s and the 1950s, you knew what it meant. You had the tools available. You could now return to the traditional insights and give them actual content and sketch out what the principles, I mean, at least you could imagine what principles might have these properties, and you could make them precise, and you could test them, and so on. And out of that confluence comes generative grammar. But it's just the natural consequence of the availability of technical tools for expressing vague intuitions.
You're a very modest man.
Well, you know, there's no doubt that it was just inevitable that that would be developed at that time. And in fact, you know, there are elements of it back to ancient India. 2,500 years ago. Transformational grammar is just one particular theory of what a generative grammar will look like. It says, here's some of the properties it ought to have, and there are other theories.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Noam Chomsky. Again, I'll press you to be make the conversation a little more personal maybe than you want it to be. Do you think that language fundamentally, are you optimistic or pessimistic about it? When we think about, acting as moral agents, resolving our problems, leading respectable, productive, fruitful political lives as well as individual lives, do you think language helps us to do that? Is it a hindrance?
It's largely irrelevant. I mean, the factors that determine our lives as moral or very often immoral agents are other ones. They have to do with the institutions of the society, the way we adapt to them, the systems of coercion and domination that exist, our willingness to stand up against them if we're honest, or even to face their existence. Those are things which are completely independent of what language you're talking and so on. The study of language is a different topic. It may ultimately, at some extremely remote level, which we're very far from reaching, connect with other investigations of human nature. But in practice, the problem of how to deal with real issues in the real world, ranging from personal life to international affairs, are completely divorced from our understanding, our very rudimentary understanding of the nature of human cognitive capacities. We act on the basis of intuition, guesswork, very thin theoretical structures like those of the social sciences, which barely deserve to be called theories. And on the basis of those, we should, if we're honest, try to sort out our moral intuitions and our expectations about the consequences of action and make decisions.
Noam Chomsky teaches at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the author of numerous publications about language, grammar, and syntax. Chomsky has also written about American politics, foreign policy, and cultural ideology. Among his recent books is a volume entitled Turning the Tide, U.S. Intervention in Central America and the Struggle for Peace. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Language and Culture continues. You'll hear next from Dennis Barron, a professor of English at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Dennis Barron's books include Grammar and Gender and The English Only Question, both available from Yale University Press. Dennis Barron, let me argue with you for a moment. Is language a thing that exists by itself? Where does language acquire its moral authority, its political authority?
It's a complex of issues, okay? Language controls us in certain ways, just as culture controls us, but we also control it, okay? So it's an interplay between a set of received standards or ways to do things with language and our own input into how we take that received language and modify it to suit our needs or at a particular time in a particular situation. So yes, there are standards and there are variations on the standards. And the thing is that the standards are fluid. And that's what we have to accept. There are always going to be standards. People are always going to judge other people on how they use language, how they write, how they speak, and so on. But these standards change over time and they change with situation.
Uh-huh. Are we talking about words or are we talking about the actions that lie behind the words?
And we're talking about attitudes toward words uh-huh. and how words are used. So, for example, let's get concrete. Take the word Ms.
Ms. M-S period.
M-S period.
Right.
Which,
or in the South, driving Ms. Daisy.
Right. Right. It's a curious example because it goes back to at least the 1930s, if not earlier, as a marriage-neutral term for women, invented, espoused, to parallel the presumably marriage-neutral term Mr. for men.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It probably derives directly from the word Miss. And there are some indications that the initial pronunciation was Miss and not Ms. as it's pronounced now.
Well, if I understand you, Dennis Barron, what you're telling me is that here is a part of the kind of neutral vocabulary that an ideological section of our mm-hmm. of our population, namely feminism, appropriates for its usage. It doesn't go out and invent the word or reshape the language.
Well, it shapes it slightly, uh-huh. okay? It modifies it. It takes something that's already there and puts a special purpose to it,
uh-huh.
okay? And although it started out, as far as I can tell, in out of the feminist movement in the early 20th century, it is curious that it's adopted by the direct mail marketing people in the late 40s and early 50s as a very useful term for addressing a customer whose marital status you don't know mm-hmm. or whose preference for title you don't know, who happens to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's no such problem with men because you just say, dear Mr. So-and-so. But the direct mail people thought this was a wonderful idea, and they didn't particularly care what grammarians or purists uh-huh. or anybody like that, or feminists for that yeah. matter, felt about it. They were looking for something that would work and get them customers that they could address without offending. Let me add to that. What's happening with Ms. now seems to be a kind of backfiring effect, that it is widely acknowledged as a term for women to use, but it is being used particularly by young women in colleges. All my students and a lot of other people around the country say their students do it too. Young women who use Ms. as a synonym for Miss, as a trendier term, a more modern or modern term for Miss. And they say, and when I get married, I'm going to be Mrs.
Well, does that mean that feminism is sort of waxing and waning here? Or
not necessarily that, but that the feminist underpinnings of the term have lost their effect, and that the language picks up the term and people use it the way they want to, no matter how it was originally intended.
All right, now I take it that you are somebody who would be against what is called sexist language, and we could use all sorts of colorful instances, but I'm not sure that that's necessary. How do you get that out of the language? For example, I was watching an episode of Cheers,
okay,
and the bartender, Sam Malone, is talking about a bimbo contest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at one level, I suppose that would make people laugh. At another level, there are people in our country who would say, I'm offended at this. I don't want it. Get it off the air. Is that sexist language? What do you do about it?
It's sexist language in the sense that it marks a category and has a very negative attitude towards. It's interesting that the word bimbo originally referred to males.
It did.
Yeah.
What does it go back, a couple of hundred years or
oh,
so?
Oh, well, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But the original references to males, and probably the O ending is instructive there. Bimba maybe would have been the feminine. And for some reason that we probably can never actually track down, it became associated with women. There are a lot of feminine terms that seem to have started out as positives and become negatives, too. Uh-huh.
So what do we do? Do we get rid of this out of the language?
Sure, take all the tapes of Cheers and tear them up, you know. Press the edit button, you know, bleep them out. How do we do it? We're not very good at controlling other people's language. You may have noticed that. You can say, don't do this, and people will probably do it even more.
Uh-huh.
It's like trying to get them to drive at the speed limit or, you know, not throw little bits of gum wrappers on the sidewalk and things like that. We don't have a mechanism to control language. It's probably not desirable that we have one.
So what do we do? We simply are aware of it and we regulate our own speech. We adjust our own sensitivity.
We regulate our own speech. And I think the biggest control on our speech, the biggest impact is audience reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want people to buy your product, to like what you have to say, to vote for you, to do whatever it is you want them to do, you've got to couch your language in terms that they're going to find acceptable.
It's the marketplace at work.
It's the marketplace at work. If you want to insult people, I mean, there's always going to be insult terms in language. You can't have it any other way. You're going to get mad at somebody. You want to have a good, juicy term to use.
Right? And on the other hand, there are moments when you will restrain yourself.
And there are moments when you will restrain yourself.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn our conversation, Dennis Barron, to another of your books. You've written a book here called The English Only Question.
Right.
Shall I load the question? Does that mean that you're for English as a national language? You're against it? Tell me what the fighting's all about.
The fighting is whether or not we should have an official language. A lot of people think that English is the official language of the United States, and technically it is not. There are no federal laws. It's not mentioned in the Constitution.
Uh-huh. What about, well, here as we sit in North Carolina, as I understand it, the legislature over in Raleigh has adopted English as the official language of the state. Is that just kind of hot air to you historians of language? What?
Well, in a lot of cases, that's all it is. It's just a symbol, like designating the state flower or the state bird, or in Illinois, we have a state fossil.
Uh-huh.
So you designate the state language as English. So right. What? What does that mean? It can have serious implications, but it doesn't necessarily have to.
Is that a way of getting, treating symptoms rather than causes? I mean, to take pride or to be ashamed of one's language is, after a fashion, to take pride in or be ashamed of one's culture. So it isn't really the words that we're arguing about. It's all the cultural stuff behind them.
Right. It's a whole, your whole ethnicity, your whole background, your whole being, because language we equate very readily with who we are, our ego.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have negative feelings about your language, that will translate into negative self-image very easily.
In a way, this goes to another of your interests, Dennis Barron, and that's literacy. That is to say, how do we figure out who's literate and how do we rank people? And unfortunately, we do that.
We
hierarchize people and jobs and titles and the language that we use reflects that. What's going on in this effort in our country to define the literate or literacy?
Well, it seems to me that literacy is a very slippery kind of term. If you want to use the broadest definition of someone who is illiterate is somebody who doesn't know what you know. And that's probably the most commonly used kind of thing. And then, of course, there's this sort of basic notion of literacy being equated with being able to read and write.
Uh-huh. Native intelligence in contrast to expressive ability.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right.
Exactly. And nobody really knows what it means to be able to read and write. I mean, we have very great difficulty and controversy over measuring.
Yeah, but don't we have to have some sense of standard? Don't we have to figure out that, you know, you got to fill out a form, you got to know how to write a check, you got to get a driver's license. Mm-hmm. Some people will argue that that's a form of discrimination on the basis of language and literacy. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I think we do discriminate and set up categories according to who can do what and how well, and whether or not we should do that is beside the point. We do it, and to some extent, you have to give people access to those skills, if you want to include them in you know, the larger community, and, and that's one of the basic problems that literacy people are trying to address.
Do you think that our colleges and universities, Dennis Barron, are training our young people to be literate? And I'm not talking about, you know, memorizing the works of Shakespeare, but there's talk these days about kids who graduate from college who are grammatically illiterate. They are functionally illiterate. They're culturally illiterate. Do we put this at the doorstep of the schools, or take it back, steps before that?
Well, it's popular to blame everybody for
yourself.
Well, no, you don't blame me for it. I didn't do it. We have blamed the schools. We have blamed the parents. We have blamed the culture. We have blamed television. We have blamed psychology. We have blamed just about everything you can put your finger on. Comic books, chewing
gum. What do? We quit blaming whoever and do what?
Accept a situation that there will always be a portion of people that you are not going to accept. Okay, that you are going to label as somehow deficient in whatever. Literacy is very contextualized, and people have been complaining about a literacy crisis for hundreds of years, about kids who don't know what we know, kids who don't know what we knew when we were kids. Is that actually true? Probably not. Yeah. They may not know the same things. They may know a lot that you didn't know.
Dennis Barron teaches at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Dennis Barron is the author of the books Grammar and Gender and The English Only Question, both available from Yale University Press. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Language and Culture is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Please ask for program number 563. That's program number 563. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete summary of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Next week, listen for conversations with two literary historians. Lois Edgerly will discuss her Daybook of Women's Writing, a volume entitled Give Her This Day. Shirley Samuels of Cornell University will discuss sentiment and sentimentality in 19th century American literature. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Language and Culture, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for two leading authorities on linguistics, Noam Chomsky of MIT and Dennis Barron of the University of Illinois. Chomsky and Barron discuss the origins of language, animal communication, artificial intelligence, sexist language, literacy, and the question of whether English should be America's official language. Language and Culture, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.